Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday afternoon. Our guest this hour, Siddharth Khara, is an expert on human trafficking and modern slavery. His first nonfiction book on contemporary slavery, Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery, was published a few years ago. His second book, Bonded Labor, Tackling the System of Slavery in South Asia, was released in 2012. And this one focused on the pervasive, deeply entrenched system of bonded labor. While sex trafficking is the most profitable form of modern-day slavery, bonded labor is the most prevalent form. He's the first fellow on human trafficking with the Center for Human Rights Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, sits on the editorial board of the Cambridge University Press book series Slavery Since Emancipation. He speaks and consults on contemporary slavery and human rights all over the world, advises the UN and various governments, and he is the author of Tainted Carpets, Slavery and Child Labor in India's Handmade Carpet Sector. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter. You can reach us on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Siddharth, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
It's one of these issues that we know exists in the world, but until we get somebody like you on the air to talk about it, we put it in the back of our minds and we have no idea how many people are involved in this. It's just a huge number of people and it's outrageous.
You know, you make a very good point. I think we are generally aware in the back of our minds that there is an extensive amount of child labor and forced labor, human trafficking around the world, but until we're put face-to-face with it, maybe through a documentary film or a research report, we don't truly appreciate the extent and expanse of child labor and slavery and just how acerbic and brutish some of these scenarios are for the workers.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the bonded workers. You have written that they are recruited by contractors who make promises to their parents. What are the promises, and who are these recruiters?
Well, debt bondage is really such a prevalent form of servile labor exploitation across Asia, and it basically works as you've described. Recruiters, traffickers, agents for factories or landowners or other producers go to areas where they know there are people who are deeply impoverished and need some sort of credit or an advance. Could be for food, could be for medicine, could be for a funeral. And they make these offers, promising that the recipient or his family can work off the debt in a reasonable circumstance. But of course, once they're transported into the factory or to the mine or whatever it might be, given their powerlessness, they're very often exploited and end up working off these debts for years or a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. You, in one of your recent articles, talked about this scene that stays in your mind, this remote shack in a rural area of India where these young children really are making handmade carpets for export to the West. What did you see there that stayed with you?
Yes, in this article I described one of the more disheartening scenarios I encountered, and this was involving a rural carpet shack, deeply, deeply embedded in a rural area, where several very young children, boys ages 8 to 12, 14, had been recruited by these traffickers and, again, with false promises, but brought into these shacks and held, forced to work night and day for carpets, weaving these carpets by hand, one thread at a time. And these carpets are all exported to the United States and sold in major retailers that you and I would very well recognize.
Mm-hmm. And there were how many? I didn't hear that number you said. How many would you say there are? Is there a way of knowing?
Well, in this particular shack and shacks like it, 15 to 20 children at a time. But in the research report that I recently released through Harvard University called Tainted Carpets, which you mentioned, We estimate that just in the carpet sector of India, there's probably around 400,000 child laborers and upwards of 900,000 forced laborers of various kinds.
Mm-hmm. And what other industries use this kind of forced labor?
Gosh, well, if we're talking about South Asia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, it's really endemic across the informal economy. So that's agriculture, mining, manufacturing, apparel, carpets, various things. And these are products that are all exported or largely exported for Western consumption.
Mm-hmm. And when you ask those places, like, well, there are so many of them, Target and Macy's and Bloomingdale's and Neiman Marcus, and the list goes on, do you know where these carpets are being made and the conditions under which they are being made? What answers do you get?
Well, most of the retailers that we've contacted further to this particular research report on handmade carpets have expressed a constructive interest in trying to address the underlying issues. And I think, to be fair to most of them, they are trying to address the issues. But oftentimes they're relying on supposedly independent or third-party inspection regimes that really aren't getting the job done.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of corruption at the local level, payoffs and bribes and whatnot. But even when there isn't, there really just isn't enough dedication and resources and sophistication to adequately inspect the tens of thousands of carpet shacks spanning northern India to ensure that they're free of child labor and forced labor and debt bondage.
And yet it was a year ago that that horrible, horrible incident took place in Bangladesh. It wasn't the first in a garment factory. It's not the first, probably not as thorough as yours, but the first investigation of child labor being used in a wide variety of industries. It seems to me as though it takes an awfully long time from recognition of a significant issue to any kind of resolution of the problem.
Well, you know, that's the sad reality, unfortunately. Yes, about a year ago at Rana Plaza in Bangladesh, there was the horrific factory collapse that cost far, far too many lives. And that kind of shocking event does grab people's attention for a moment. But you're right, it takes so much time and there's so much back and forth and ultimately ineffective efforts to really systematically and on a sustained basis loot out these issues. I can remember being in that plaza and factories like it in Bangladesh in 2010, looking around at the really, really horrific subhuman working conditions and thinking to myself, this is a disaster waiting to happen. And sure enough, a few later, that's sadly exactly what happened.
Yeah. I know you have been operating at pretty high levels here, Siddharth. You were sent by the State Department to discuss anti-trafficking initiatives with the governments of Singapore and also of Malaysia. You advise governments on anti-slavery policy and law all over the world. What do you bring to those governments? What do you say to them?
Well, it's largely on a case-by-case basis. So, for example, yes, you're right. The Department of State here sent me to a few countries to speak with them and advise them on human trafficking. And in some cases, the conversation is really just getting them to acknowledge that there is a problem, that this is an issue that is affecting them. We're actually starting at that point in some cases. In other cases, countries may have recognized it, but not have a law in place or not have adequate measures in place or really not a sufficiently nuanced understanding of the phenomenon, which is leading to ineffective efforts to tackle it. So the conversations might be around guidance on, well, how do you start to write an effective law against human trafficking? And how do you adequately investigate and prosecute human trafficking offenses and cooperate transnationally? So there's an array of various types of conversations and initiatives that one has when engaging on this issue around the world, because there's a various array of circumstances one faces around the world.
Are any of those governments being bribed?
Well, I can't say for sure. I've never documented myself personally a bribe to a government official from a human trafficker, but we certainly have ample anecdotal evidence that government officials, judiciary, law enforcement in various countries may be bribed or may be part of a scheme or system of human trafficking and child labor just to look the other way. In some cases, they may have economic interests in the industries that are relying on child labor or human trafficking victims. Mm.
Considering how many people are involved, you just gave us some phenomenally high numbers. It's hard to believe that any government on this planet would not be aware of what was going on.
Well, and this 400,000 was just for one sector in one country.
Yes.
We have a general sense that around the world, conservatively, there are probably 200 to 300 million child laborers.
Wow.
In an extremely dangerous or hazardous scenario, and upwards of probably 150 million, what we call the worst forms of child labor, this is human trafficking, sexual servitude, armed conflict, forced labor. I mean, really the worst of the worst. So you're absolutely right. The numbers are staggering. And while we are aware of it, the efforts to tackle this issue and the resources that are deployed to tackle the issue are really far, far behind the magnitude of the issue.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's more prevalent in other countries, but knowing that we were going to be talking about this, I was struck by an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel over the weekend highlighting a program to help Wisconsin victims of child sex trafficking. This is certainly something you don't imagine is going on in your home state.
Well, you're right. We largely set our eyes abroad when we're thinking about child labor and child trafficking or slavery in modern times. But absolutely, these issues are happening domestically as well. There is, without a doubt, child sex trafficking cases across the United States. And we're not talking just major cities like New York or Atlanta or Los Angeles, but in the heart of the country as well. I documented some cases of sex trafficking in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hmm. So, yes, this is happening domestically, child sex trafficking, human trafficking for labor and construction and agriculture, and even organ trafficking that I've documented along the South Texas-Mexico border.
Tell me, Siddharth, before we invite phone calls, I know that you, from reading your resume, you really made a rather dramatic change in the course of your life, didn't you, to do this kind of work? You used to be doing all right, making quite a bit of money in a whole different sector. Why did you change what you're doing?
Yes, that's true. I was trained in finance and law and was working as an investment banker in New York in the late 1990s, but really started to think at that point in time, what do I really want to do with my life, and how can I be of benefit to the world other than just working and making a paycheck for myself? And I had an experience in a refugee camp in Bosnia as an undergraduate where I first came across sex trafficking. Mm. And I just made a radical shift in my life. I thought, well, if I'm ever going to try to tackle something like this or do something about it or even make an effort, this is the point in time. And I did make that change and started researching this issue. And it's just consumed me ever since. Now, 14 years later, I continue to travel around the world and do research firsthand into slavery and child labor of all kinds.
Mm. We're going to welcome phone calls. Here's how you can reach us. Siddharth Kara is our guest this hour, one of the world's foremost experts on human trafficking and contemporary slavery. He's director of the Program on Human Trafficking and Modern Slavery at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He is visiting scientist on forced labor at Harvard School of Public Health, author of Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery, which won the 2010 Frederick Douglass Award at Yale University for the best nonfiction book on slavery, also author of Bonded Labor, Tackling the System of Slavery in South Asia, which was released in 2012, and he is the author of Tainted Carpets, which is his thorough examination of slavery and child labor in India's handmade carpet sector. Everybody always asks when we talk about particularly this bonded labor, what responsibility consumers have, what responsibilities do retailers have, how do you end this horrendous practice of very young people, anybody for that matter, but there's something particularly horrendous about young children, 10 years old, even younger, who are in shacks making carpets thread by thread to send to the United States so that we can put them on our living room floors? Something doesn't settle right with that. What do you think? Our phone number, our lines are open, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that is @KDunnShow. Lines are open. I wanted to tell you that tomorrow during this time period, he's been with us before. Harvey Kay will be our guest, and he will be talking about the fight for the four freedoms, what made FDR and the greatest generation truly great. It's a story he believes, the fight for four freedoms that we cannot forget, and that freedom from want and from fear, freedom of speech and religion, are very, very important principles to guide us. And he writes about how that generation needs to be remembered now, and those freedoms need to be remembered, and we may have lost our way a bit. Harvey's an interesting guy. He wrote that book. We interviewed him some years ago on the Thomas Paine book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. And it was a huge bestseller. He is with us to talk about FDR and the Four Freedoms tomorrow during this hour. All right, to phone calls momentarily, you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls, starting with Andrea in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I'm wondering how gender plays into this issue, not only for those involved in the trafficking, but...
Okay, I think we lost you, but I think we can fill in the rest of that sentence. Siddharth?
Excellent question from the caller. Gender is a primary driver, along with ethnicity, of vulnerability to being trafficked and exploited. Obviously, for sexual exploitation, female gender is a primary force. But oftentimes in many of these countries, it is females that are more disenfranchised, have less access to rights, opportunities, education, which clearly makes them more vulnerable to numerous modes of exploitation, including trafficking, forced labor, and child labor.
Hmm. So when you're looking at solutions to this, education, if everybody had a chance to be going to school, it seems to me as though that might be one of the primary things we need to do to stop this.
Well, education is crucial. Literacy and education lead to enhanced economic opportunities. But the crucial element to bear in mind vis-a-vis education is that for many of these families, and we're talking about family units that are living on $1, $1.50 or less per day.
Mm-hmm.
For many of these family units, the payoffs of education come down the road, whereas the immediate economic needs they face in this level of poverty often require them to send children into labor scenarios. So we have to make sure that while we promote education of women and children, we are also supporting the economic needs of these families so they don't have to face that terrible scenario of having to forfeit an education just to go earn 50 cents a day.
Right. Thank you, Andrea, for your call. Tim and Ladysmith, hi.
Hi. I guess a couple of questions I had is worked with an organization out of the Asian area. It's called Gospel for Asia, and they have a program where you can buy kids out of indebted labor slavery for like $17, I think. And I don't know if your guest was familiar with any of organizations like that. Also, the other question I had, though, is especially in the West, what is the contributing factor he thinks pornography plays in the sex trade industry? And I'll hang up and take my
phone. All right, Tim, thanks for the call.
Well, there are certainly various grassroots organizations, NGOs, and initiatives that try to get people out of a debt bondage scenario, perhaps by discharging debts, so that they can earn and work for themselves. The primary challenge faced by many of these initiatives is that it can't be a one-time event, because the family unit is going to face repeated economic shocks and crises. Someone will fall ill. Monsoons will wash away the home. There will be enough food and water on any given week. So the pulling someone out of a debt bondage scenario has to be concurrent with promoting their economic well-being and development and security on a long-term basis so they don't slip back in.
Who are the people who are walking around or driving around rounding up poor people and children to put them into bonded labor?
Well, it's an array of individuals. If we're, again, talking about South Asia, it's very often local contractors and local agents who know these areas well, know the rural areas well, know the villages well, and know who's right at that precipice of desperation, of extreme desperation, and they will make offers. Oftentimes, this is happening on the cusp of an environmental disaster. Could be a flood, could be a monsoon event, could be a hurricane. And these are agents working for companies that swoop in and start recruiting workers. They could also be recruiters and agents of major international corporations. Oftentimes, the recruitment is for construction jobs in the Middle East or East Asia or even in Europe, recruit formal, very, very sophisticated recruitment agencies will go into countries like Bangladesh and Nepal and recruit workers with offers of permits and high-level construction jobs, promising wages that are like a dream-level wage for individuals. And then they're often exploited and then deported once their tenure is done.
Yeah. Do you ever find it just incredibly disillusioning and depressing that there can be that many people in this world who have no sense of humanity?
Well, yes. Given the amount of time I have spent in the field, not just documenting slaves and child laborers, but also confronting their exploiters, one does come face-to-face with some of the darkest, most callous, and most exploitative sides of human nature. And it can be a debilitating encounter. It can be very depressing and overwhelming. Overwhelming because of the sheer callousness of some of these individuals, the greed, but also just the magnitude of the issue can be quite overwhelming and quite disheartening.
Mm-hmm. Do any of them ever get arrested? Are they brought to task for their actions?
Yes. Traffickers and agents are prosecuted and investigated and sometimes convicted, but it is honestly not even one drop in the ocean relative to the size of the issue. There's just not enough resources to investigate, particularly in the developing world, and certainly there's always corruption as a factor as well.
Yeah. Mike in southern Wisconsin, hi.
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 Maybe the we can hear some comments on the sex trade that's going on through the Great Lakes. We don't see it in mainstream newspapers, but through Native American newspapers and stuff, you see a lot of it, where they lure women to Thunder Bay, Ontario, and Superior, Wisconsin, you know, as promises of good jobs and stuff, and they end up in the sex trade. They end up on these ships, and many of them leave this country. But we don't hear about it. You know, this is not third world country. But we don't hear about it in mainstream newspapers.
Where are you hearing?
Media.
Where are you hearing about this, Mike?
You, all you got to do is pick up Indian News Today, or any of the native newspapers, and they talk about it all the time. But it never makes it the mainstream.
Siddharth.
They believe there's at least 8,000 women missing right now.
Mm. Siddharth, are you familiar with this?
Yes, I have heard some of the stories that the caller is referring to, and he makes a good point. Now, I will say the mainstream media does cover sex trafficking and human trafficking domestically much more now than they did 14 years ago when I started my research. But the caller is right. There isn't enough coverage in the mainstream media, particularly of some of these sort of local stories and local networks and local sex trafficking crime groups. And certainly there's been quite a long-standing phenomenon of sex trafficking through Native Indian sovereign territory that's bordering between Canada and the United States, as well as, of course, Native Indians themselves out of those territories into the sex trade and into labor as well.
Hmm. Thank you, Mike, very much. We'll look more carefully into that story. Bringing it back to, I think you have a list of 10 things that could be done to address this problem, and you must bring that list with you when you're talking to governments and people all over the world, members of the UN, about sex trafficking. What are the things that need to be addressed? What's on that list of 10, Siddharth?
Well, I think the most useful way to think about this is looking at the list and dividing it between issues that address the supply side, the supply of potential victims, and then the demand for those victims. So on the supply side, the primary initiatives are things we've discussed today, things like addressing immense poverty, bridging the gender gap, addressing gender issues, minority issues, child rights, et cetera. Promoting education and economic opportunity and stability. Doing those types of things help people be less vulnerable to being trafficked and exploited, and children to stay in school and not be sent into factories and mines. But we also bear part of the responsibility for this issue. The companies that work are headquartered here, and we as consumers demand cheaper goods and cheaper products each and every day. And in a global economy, most of these multinational corporations, or many of them, provide us these cheap goods and boost their shareholder value along the way by sourcing cheap labor in cheap labor markets. And so we also have to demand that companies and our governments assure us that, yes, you want to source low-wage labor on the far side of the world, that's fine, but it can't be children. And it can't be forced labor, and it can't be human trafficking and other slave-like exploitative practices. So we have to demand that as consumers from our companies and from our governments, and then they need to invest in the kinds of activities, certifications, and supply chain tracing that will assure us as consumers that the things we're buying every day are not tainted by child labor.
Yeah. So how can you trust certification? Where is good certification taking place?
Honestly, right now, I think that's really a challenge. Part of what my report on carpets was intended to demonstrate is that even though there are supposedly third-party certification regimes in place for this particular commodity and other commodities as well, they simply do not address the array of exploitative conditions one finds in these supply chains. Child labor, debt bondage, human trafficking, et cetera. And they simply do not cover a sufficient portion of the production base. So they may check the level one factory in the case of carpets, but not level two, three, four, five, and six, all the way down into the rural areas where most of the problems are occurring. So right now it is a real challenge for a consumer to look out into the world and find a credible, rigorous, robust certification regime that will assure them that this carpet or that coffee or this rice is reliably untainted by slavery and child labor.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe in boycotting?
My fundamental concern with boycotting is that if we issue a blanket boycott on, let's say, a particular commodity from a particular country, carpets from India, for example, in the near term, we will probably end up doing more unintended harm than good. Of course, we would eliminate the issue of child slave-made carpets being sold in the United States because there wouldn't be any. They'd be boycotted. But in the near term, the 25 cents that child might be making that day could be the difference between eating and starving for his family or her family. So I have concerns with boycotts because of the unintended near-term harm that it potentially can do to the most vulnerable workers. And I think a more staged approach to addressing the underlying exploitation is a better way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by that, a more staged approach?
Well, first and foremost, we have to design and deploy certification regimes that recognize the array of exploitative practices that are prevalent and have enough resources and independence and credibility to do their work reliably. The next step is to then start deploying some of those supply-side issues. promoting the economic development and education of these low-wage informal economy workers so that they aren't perpetually vulnerable to exploitation and human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
In that way, we will slowly get to a point where if after doing that for a few years, there are still carpets that are coming through or other commodities that are coming through as tainted, we could then think about a boycott as a way to motivate industry and the government to finish the job that we've started.
Mm-hmm. What's striking about this, Siddharth, is that being able to make these carpets, which I'm sure sell for a pretty penny here and in other markets, that it's a craft that you can easily imagine, I'm sure, when you're seeing these young children, that this is something that could be done by older people in places all over India and all over South Asia, and they could be getting a decent wage for creating something that is beautiful that people in other parts of the world can really afford to buy, and they should be rewarded for their labor. Is it so hard to figure that out?
No, it's not. And one of the reasons I chose carpets to be my first detailed investigation into slavery and child labor in a commodity supply chain. I hope this will be the first of many commodities I'm conducting, commodity research projects I'm conducting. But one of the reasons I chose carpets to start with is precisely because of this, because it puts very sharply into focus the realities of the underbelly of the global economy, which is that the suffering of child slaves and adult human trafficking victims is transformed by our economy into these beautiful things we buy every
day. Right.
And that reality, that is the essential reality of slavery and child labor in today's global economy. And it is something that we buy to beautify our homes. And we do spend thousands of dollars for some of these beautiful handmade carpets, whereas the worker who made it may have made cents a day, 25, mm-hmm. 30, 40 cents a day. And that disparity and that injustice and that asymmetry is at the heart of some of the fundamental problems with the current nature of the global economy.
Right. Well, let's welcome more phone calls about the current nature of the global economy. Our guest this hour is one of the world's foremost experts on human trafficking and contemporary slavery. He's written two important books a couple of years ago, and this was a winner of the Frederick Douglass Award at Yale for the best nonfiction book on slavery. The book Inside the Business of Modern Slavery, Sex Trafficking is the title, really. And the second, Bonded Labor, Tackling the System of Slavery in South Asia, released just a couple years ago. He has been looking most recently at carpets and slavery and child labor in India's handmade carpet sector. I mean, it's a huge issue where so many people and children being exploited. At least we can start with children, have them not be starving and living in shacks and not seeing the light of day and making absolutely nothing so that people can have fancy carpets. It goes beyond carpets, but that's what he looked at most recently. The underbelly of the world economy this hour. Here's our phone number again. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to phone calls, more of them now, for Siddharth Kara. He is also at Kennedy School of Government at Harvard right now, where he is the first fellow on human trafficking with the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. Let's go to Jay in De Pere next. Hi, Jay.
Hi. I've only heard the last few minutes, but kudos to your guest for such amazing and important work. I'd like to ask him if you can recommend an NGO or a website to which we can contribute in support of this kind of work.
Well, there are certainly an array of very, very dedicated, reputable NGOs working on various facets of human trafficking, child labor, both domestically and abroad. It's hard to just name a couple on the air that stand out because there are so many, and working in so many different countries. But for example, if you were really concerned about the issue domestically, a few NGOs that come to mind that are working on the issue here would be the Polaris Project, International Justice Mission, the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking, the American Himalayan Foundation. These are some very reputable NGOs that are doing dedicated work to tackle this issue domestically as well as transnationally. Looking abroad, there are just so many, it's hard to narrow down the list. But that would be a good start if you were thinking just domestically.
And what about to find out about the work that you're doing, Siddharth?
Well, certainly just Googling my name will pull up a lot of information on my publications and research. And then looking at both the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights at the School of Public Health at Harvard and the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard will give you some information on human trafficking in our projects as well.
All right. Is that helpful, Jay? Jay's gone. I assume it's helpful. Thanks for your call. 800-486-8655. Catherine is next. Hi, Catherine?
Hi. In the early 90s, my husband was working for an NGO with urban refugees in Khartoum, Sudan. And I'm an artist, and it was the first time we lived there. But anyway, I would go sometimes to the souk in Omdurman, the big one, and a couple of times when I was there, I witnessed young Southern Sudanese men in the market who were slaves, and the owners would kind of ratchet up their behavior with the slaves just for my benefit. I just quit going. It's too difficult. And I think that there are very few people in this country who have witnessed slavery of any kind at all. And, you know, like the abolitionists were right. And thank you for having this program. I really admire your work. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call, Catherine. Siddharth, would you like to respond?
Well, I think the caller's sort of personal experience of encountering slavery is really a poignant one. And she's right. Not enough people have experienced or borne witness to this. And when you do, when you really come face to face with it, it really is a life-altering experience to see a human being in today's day and age oppressed and subjugated and denied their dignity and free will. That's a life-altering experience. It was for me. I'm sure it was for the caller and for others who are doing this research.
Mm. It must have been, and you saw not just only the boys that you described, the 10 to 14-year-olds who were living in this shack and weren't seeing the light of day, but it must just be so difficult to have to leave them.
Well, without question. Some of the slaves that I've seen, particularly in scenarios where they're being enforced prostitution and brothels and massage parlors, and especially when it's children, the impulse is to obviously intervene immediately to get them out of that horrific circumstance, because every minute that they're in it is such a barbaric situation. The trouble is one doesn't exactly know right there and then what the whole situation is.
Mm-hmm.
Their parents could be under threat from local agents, and if the child is pulled out of the shack or the brothel, harm could come to their family that certainly I or the other person trying to intervene couldn't prevent. And it's very, very important to work with local organizations that will carefully understand what's happening in a situation and slowly and carefully extract someone, if possible, from that kind of a scenario, because you may end up doing much more harm than good.
Right.
Or if you pull them out there and then, they may end up right back in that situation once you've gone a week or two later.
Yeah. Thank you, Catherine, for your call. Bridget in Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. So I've previously learned about this subject in my eighth grade history class last year. And we were reading a book called Iqbal, which was about a boy in the a shack who created rugs in India.
Mm.
And I kind of had a question thinking, if this kind of touchy subject, like as human trafficking and child labor laws and cheaply made products, would become less taboo in the near future?
Well, let me first say that I'm so heartened to hear that a young person in the 8th or 9th grade is reading and learning about child labor and human trafficking. That's certainly a marked change from when I started my research 14, 15 years ago. So kudos to that school. There are aspects of this issue that remain taboo, but I think a lot of those taboos have started to dismantle, and we are able to engage in constructive conversations and frankly, honest conversations about this issue. But many people still don't want to talk about it, don't want to acknowledge it, or don't want to accept that it might touch their lives. And the important thing to bear in mind is that even when slavery or child labor is happening on the far side of the world, never mind locally, but on the far side of the world, it could still very well touch our lives by virtue of the things we buy and purchase each and every day.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Unless you had something else, Bridget.
No, that's all.
Okay. It is remarkable that you're studying about this and reading about it in eighth grade. Where do you go to school?
I went to a middle school called Pilgrim Park Middle School. We just learned about what was in the book. Not much about human trafficking, though.
Right, right. But it piqued your curiosity. Thank you so much for your call. And sometimes I was struck by an article in the New York Times sometime this weekend, Saturday or Friday or Saturday, that sometimes we're looking at the spoils of war, too, or part of warfare in many countries. This is referring to your sex trafficking book, this story from Nigeria, where dozens of schoolgirls were abducted by armed militants in northeastern Nigeria last week. They remained missing on Thursday, and fears they would be turned into sex slaves and cooks if they were not rescued. They were kidnapped from a state school in the heartland of the Boko Haram insurgency. There's been horrors going on there, but evidently 10 of the girls who were forced to cook for the Boko Haram, the governor said, they used the leaves of the trees to clean the plates, and they took an opportunity to escape. Some of them jumped off the trucks that the gunmen had crammed them into. And so this kind of thing happens in wartime all over the world, doesn't it?
I'm really glad you brought this up, because military conflict is one of the leading drivers of vulnerability to trafficking, child labor, and slave-like exploitation. Because it leads to instant population displacement and a lack of security, people are desperate to move out of harm's way, and they're often recruited by traffickers. And I have been to Nigeria.
Oh.
Conducted an extensive amount of research in Nigeria, because I have encountered so many Nigerian trafficking victims across Europe, Asia, and in the United States.
Really? Really?
And the scenario there was so bleak and disheartening. I came across baby factories in Lagos and deep in villages. Absolutely, families were constantly anxious of this kind of activity, of militias coming through and abducting girls or even boys. So they were desperate to get out of harm's way, to get into Europe or some other part of the world where they could have a secure existence. And this feeds into that desperation and that fear. And part of the other thing that is happening in Nigeria in particular is very, very specific cultural factors, where many of these trafficking victims undergo certain voodoo and juju rituals that ensnare them in a kind of servitude where they feel their very spirit is at peril if they speak out against their trafficker or obey what their exploiter is telling them. So, yeah, it's a very bleak scenario in Nigeria.
Whoa, and deeper and deeper and deeper we go, Wow. Thank you for your call. Barb is next in Menominee Falls. Hi, Barb.
Hello. Just wanted to say that a few years back, I worked with a group led by Salvatorean Sisters, Sister Patrice Coletti, and she was working to get legislation in the state of Wisconsin against trafficking. And it was a very, very hard process because people, especially the legislators, were in denial. But we did get a minimum type piece of legislation signed by Governor Doyle. And really, I haven't heard much more. You know, they said it took too much money to train the police department or the, you know, the officials to be able to recognize if someone is being, might be being trafficked. And I went here in Menominee Falls, our little village, and I wanted to talk to someone from the police department. Well, they didn't laugh me out, but they said that's not going on around here or in Wisconsin. Yet it's going on in Minnesota, Chicago, in Detroit, around Michigan. But they think we're an oasis, and it just doesn't exist here.
Mm-hmm. And what led the group that you were working with to want legislation? What were they seeing in Wisconsin?
Well, the sister had more of the in the city of Milwaukee in particular. You know, pimps and people were trafficking young people from other areas here.
Mm-hmm.
And in Brookfield, we had a doctor and his wife who had a maid from Central America, and she lived a non-existent life. Neighbors didn't even know she lived there.
Right, I remember that story.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they were prosecuted. I haven't heard any more about it, but I mean, it is going on here, and we are in denial.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call, Barb. Do you find that that's true? You, of all people, have this world response to this because you're traveling everywhere, documenting and then meeting with government leaders. Do you find that a number of people all over the world seem to be in denial about this, Siddharth?
Yes, I think there's certainly been progress in the last decade, but there is, without question, still an appalling degree of complete denial that the issue is affecting a particular country or a particular community. The fact of the matter is that is a major, major barrier to progress and to effective efforts to tackle the issue, this complete level of denial. And the caller also made another important point, which is a reality, and that is the fact that it does take resources to investigate human trafficking cases, to prosecute offenders, to protect the witness, the survivor. All of that does take resources, and many times, and particularly in challenging economic times, resources are hard to come by, and politicians and governments have to make decisions about where they can allocate resources. Now, I fundamentally believe this issue is one that should not be shortchanged, but it's hard sometimes to get political support to allocate resources to protect victims of human trafficking and to investigate those offenses properly.
Yeah. Have you been able to document? Do you take cameras with you, or is that too dangerous?
By and large, it is very risky to take any sort of recording equipment, audiovisual cameras, even voice recorders, into places where a victim is being exploited in slave-like exploitation there and then. The researcher is, of course, at risk, but more importantly, the person that you might be trying to document is at risk. If you're seen having a camera or talking to them or photographing them, the exploiter will invariably punish the person that you were interviewing or documenting very severely to just avoid any risk of exposure. So it's very dangerous to take cameras and other equipment into some of these areas. I have done it, and with enough experience, I can use my judgment where it might be okay,
yes,
and safe to take some photos. I'm not very talented with video cameras, so I've never shot footage or anything. But
mm-hmm.
I have taken photos and tried to share those in some of my publications so that people can see what these places look
right.
like.
Right. Siddharth, thank you very much for being with us. You're a brave man. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Siddharth Kara. He is the author of several books, Bonded Labor, Tackling the System of Slavery in South Asia, Sex Trafficking Inside the Business of Modern Slavery, and he is teaching He is at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the show and for on-air production. Tomorrow, 40 years ago today, was the first Earth Day. We'll be talking about how it started right here in Wisconsin and sharing the story of how a 1970 teach-in created the first green generation.